KUI News Beer Vote. I'm Laurel Bowman.
A Tanzanian and opposition party said on Sunday both its campaign manager and its parliamentary candidate in Zanzibar have been abducted by unknown assailants. This comes days before elections are due on October 28th. ACT Wazalendo Party said in a statement that its campaign manager for the semi-autonomous archipelago was also seen being beaten by Zanzibar special security forces. Zanzibar police were not immediately available to comment. Zanzibar and mainland Tanzania are due to hold elections for president, lawmakers, and local governments on Wednesday. Zanzibar has previously been rocked by post-election violence back in 2001, resulting in the death of more than 35 people. Pope Francis named 13 new Roman Catholic cardinals on Sunday, including 9 under the age of 80 who were eligible to enter a conclave to elect his successor after his death or resignation. The new cardinals include Archbishop Wilton Gregory of Washington, D.C. He will be the first African-American to hold the rank. He's 72 years old, so he will be able to weigh in on a new pope. Others in the group hail from Italy, Rwanda, the Philippines, Chile, and Brunei. The 9 will be elevated to this high rank at a ceremony at the Vatican next month. Italy on Sunday ordered bars and restaurants to close by 6 p.m. and shut public gyms, cinemas, and swimming pools to try and halt a rapid resurgence in the coronavirus that has pushed daily infection rates to new records. The measures take effect on Monday and were agreed between Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's government in Rome and regional authorities. This follows 2 nights of protest in Naples and Rome against curfews introduced last week in several other regions. This is VOA News. Nearly 9,000 people fled their homes in the Philippines as Typhoon Malave made landfall. The typhoon crossed over provinces on the southern part of the main Luzon island on Sunday. It brought heavy rain and strong winds, officials said. The Disaster Monitoring Agency said it had received reports of damaged roads and bridges and flooding and landslides in some areas, but there were no casualties reported so far. With sustained winds of 130 kilometers per hour, the typhoon intensified into a typhoon as it moved westward and made landfall over San Miguel Island and Albay province early in the evening. Sea travel operations were canceled in danger zones, with 569 people stranded at ports due to strong winds, again, according to the Disaster Monitoring Agency. After crossing the Philippine archipelago, Malave was expected to continue intensifying over the South China Sea, the Weather Bureau said. A key al-Qaeda leader has been killed in Afghanistan's eastern Ghazni province by Afghan forces. Abu Musin al-Masr was an Egyptian national believed to be the group's number 2 in the Indian subcontinent. He was wanted by the United States for providing support and resources to a foreign terrorist organization and plotting to kill U.S. nationals, according to the U.S. FBI. The Afghan government Sunday accused the Taliban of still keeping close ties with the Islamist militant group, despite promises the Taliban had made to the contrary. Afghanistan's interior minister said the killing of the al-Qaeda leader shows the close ties which still exist between the Taliban and terrorist groups. The Taliban's sheltering of al-Qaeda was the original reason for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after the September 11, 2001 attacks in the United States. In a landmark deal with the U.S. in February, the Taliban agreed to not allow Afghan soil to be used by foreign extremists, including al-Qaeda, in return for Washington withdrawing its troops from the country. Meanwhile, the death toll from a bomb blast claimed by the Islamic State group at a higher education center in Kabul rose to 24 on Sunday, most of them students. An Interior Ministry spokesman said another 57 people had been wounded in Saturday's attack in a western district of the capital. Students were seen on Sunday morning salvaging books from a building damaged by the blast. Residents in several districts of western Kabul belong to the minority Shiite Hazara community and are often targeted by Sunni extremists of Islamic State. For more on these and other international stories, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Berman for VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
For presidential victory, we're talking about 90 plus. For members of parliament, we're talking about 75% plus. For councillors, we're talking about 80 to 85% plus.
The Tanzanian ruling party says voters overwhelmingly support President John Magufuli's re-election agenda ahead of this week's general election.
The members of the NDA, most people that spoke at the meeting also, do not also believe that the government is actually taking any serious step in dealing with the issue at hand. And that's why we have this series of protests still going on.
The Nigerian Bar Association calls on the government to genuinely address concerns of the youth protests.
We are waiting on the Inspector General of Police to act so that we will know and have that belief that going into this election, any individual or group of persons who have an ambition to foment trouble or to perpetrate any violence will be brought to book.
And a Ghanaian civil society group warns against violence in the run-up to the December 7 polls. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzania's ruling party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi, or CCM, says it remains confident the party's presidential candidate, incumbent President John Magufuli, will win Wednesday's election in a landslide. Humphrey Polepole, the party's ideology and publicity secretary, says the group's internal polling shows overwhelming support for the president's re-election bid, as well as down-ballot candidates. This, despite an anticipated stiff challenge from attorney Tundu Lissu, the presidential candidate for the main opposition party, Chadema. The party insists Lissu will win if the elections are transparent and credible. The statement follows criticism that the National Electoral Commission is biased in favor of the incumbent president and his governing party, the CCM. But Humphrey Polepole tells me voters are well aware of the success the president has chalked in the last 5 years and are determined to re-elect him.
First of all, I would like to make it very clear that the Tanzanian general election 2020 is conducted within the premises of the national constitution, the electoral laws and other related laws in Tanzania. We have a schedule that we are following from the National Electoral Commission, and as Chama Chama Pinduzi, we have followed that very closely. We have adhered to all the constitutional directives, the electoral law directives, and we're good to go. We've had a very successful, very scientifically done campaign. We started this campaign having a foundation, which is our outstanding work and performance of the 5 years that Comrade John Pombe Joseph Magufuli, President of Tanzania, and the presidential candidate for Chama Cha Mapinduzi has done. So we're actually going into this general election having already a capital of victory, plus the very civilized campaigns that we've conducted, and we have preached policies, unity, peace, but also harmony. And Comrade Magufuli has made it very clear about the successes we have gained within these 5 years. We are going to even double them in the next 5 years.
Mr. Polepole, Tundu Lissu, the main presidential challenger from Chadema, is of the view that they have better plans to improve the living conditions of the people of Tanzania, that their manifesto is superior, and that Tanzanians trust them more, they will repose confidence in them more, and that President Magufuli has failed the people of Tanzania. What do you say to that? Do you think your manifesto is superior?
Our manifesto explicitly describes a number of strategic developmental projects that we would unleash them across Tanzania. going to be more employment for young people, more health facilities, free education for all, healthcare and free healthcare, and having, you know, that given to our people. So Tanzanians have received our campaign very positively. We have been welcomed by multitudes of people. Our rallies are, you know, full of people everywhere we go. And we're very happy, and we are very thankful to Tanzanians in the manner that they have been so far in terms of supporting our campaign.
So, Mr. Polepole, are you therefore saying that the CCM is confident President Magufuli will be re-elected?
President Magufuli will be re-elected with a very, you know, landslide victory. So far, the research that we've done scientifically, for presidential victory, we were talking about 90 plus. For members of parliament, we're talking about 75% plus. For councillors, we're talking about 80 to 85% plus.
What makes you so confident about these figures?
I have told you, we've come to this campaign with a capital in our hands. And this capital is the outstanding work that we've done. You should remember, Tanzania is the only country that is economically stable within the Great Lakes region, despite the adverse effects of the COVID-19. Our economic performance has progressed very well. We have maintained 6 to 7% of GDP growth. That is completely far ahead of most of the African countries.
Humphrey Polepole is the Tanzania ruling party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi's ideology and publicity secretary. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Member of Sudan's opposition Broad National Movement, or BNM, says the group is against moves to normalize relations with Israel. Attorney Hisham Abu Riada says the Sudanese transitional government may not have the legal backing to normalize relations with Israel. He says the government should rather focus on finding ways to improve the living conditions of citizens. His remarks come after U.S. President Donald Trump announced Sudan and Israel will begin to normalize relations Friday. The announcement makes Sudan the third Arab country to establish relations with Israel. Analysts say the latest developments could significantly boost Sudan's attractiveness to foreign direct investment.
When the revolutions started in Sudan, the revolutions is come like a threat of dictatorship regime in Sudan. And we saw an state of like they're going to do that. The very important things, I mean, to find out, like, to help our economically, to make the peace, to improve human rights and so. They starting straight away to do, like, this kind of normalizations and that one. And even if, like, to do that one, they need to go through the parliament. And even until now, there's no any parliament since this new government has come to
Isn't this a good thing for the people of Sudan? Because some Sudanese are telling me, in the face of it, it will help attract foreign direct investment to Sudan to improve the living conditions of Sudan. So those who are against it, they argue that are against Sudan taking steps to being embraced in the international community.
To improve the living conditions in Sudan, our country is a very rich country. I mean, we have very good, like, for land, we can do for agriculture. We have, like, oil, we have many things to do. I mean, when they start, they try, I mean, to remove the name of our Sudan from the list. And they start, they say they need to be, like, compensation is like $365 million to give for the family of the victims in America. And after that, because they have like a hidden agenda, when they announce this kind of like to sign agreement for to have this a good relation between Sudan and Israel, the most of the Sudanese people now they are in shock, because from the first place when no agree since 1967, since like has been the Arab League has been in Sudan in 1967. They says like they cannot recognize Israel, they cannot do any kind of dialogues, they cannot. Okay, this is our commitment as a Sudanese towards our brothers in Palestine. But when they start straight away make that one, they say maybe that deal is being done. Okay, that's they thought America will give us like they start giving us like money, they giving us like they will help us a lot. But I think this is a misleading, and even Prime Minister now he's in a deep trouble, because when Burhan,
why do you think the Prime Minister is in deep trouble?
Yeah, but I mean as the Prime Minister when in the first place when Al Burhan he went and he met Netanyahu in Entebbe, and one day like they ask the Prime Minister, and he says he doesn't even have any idea about this kind of like that kind of meeting, and even his ally of there is not now any kind of like trust between him and our people in Sudan, because now in reality Hamdok, he knows everything. He knows that there is a kind of like normalization is going to be in first place, since like they signed for that kind of an agreement and they removed the Sudan from the list. I mean even like there is a commitment, as I told you earlier. I mean, we cannot become a part of, we don't know. I mean, even if you ask me, the people they have like a normalization with Israel. What Israel they give to them? Okay, nothing. The Israel they gonna come and they gonna invest in Sudan. Even America they will start as well to try like to make like more, many things. I mean, we'll not give our people in Sudan nothing.
Attorney Hisham Abu Riada, a leading member of the Sudanese Broad National Movement, tells me it may be illegal for the transitional government in Khartoum to normalize relations with Israel. Attorney Hisham Abu Riada is a leading member of the Sudanese Opposition Broad National Movement, or BNM. He spoke with me from the British capital, London. A prominent member of the Church of Uganda says the church group is supporting government's effort to stop the spread of the novel coronavirus. Mrs. Barbara Mugisha of the province of the Church of Uganda says the group has launched a series of sensitization programs on all media platforms to educate citizens about the disease. She also adds that the church has partnered with other religious groups in the effort to limit the spread of the disease. The government has recently eased imposed movement restrictions as part of the measures to limit the spread of the disease. But opposition and civil society groups criticize the government of using the restrictions to undermine their campaign effort in the run-up to next year's general election. Mrs. Barbara Mugisha of the province of the Church of Uganda tells me the church is increasing efforts to stop the spread of the disease in the East African country.
The Church of Uganda has been well coordinated to support the existing structures, particularly the government, in fighting the COVID-19. The Church of Uganda, particularly women in this country, have been well coordinated, making of sanitizers, making of masks, all this meant to help in the hand washing to prevent the further spread of COVID-19. We've also been able to support the local communities to raise awareness on the spread of the COVID using their various media channels, mostly the radio channels and the television channels, to help the rural communities to have an idea of how this COVID-19 is spread and how they can prevent it. And we've also carried on online training sessions for the very many leaders to help disseminate information to the grassroots.
How
has the reaction from Ugandans been in terms of your advocacy to help sensitize them about how dangerous this is and how to keep themselves safe?
The reaction has been positive because after realizing that there are actually increasing cases of infections for COVID-19 and increasing deaths, people got this kind of fear within them to be able to protect and prevent further spread. People have really known that this is a killer disease and so have ignored the very many misinformation that has always hindered them to think the COVID-19 pandemic is a serious killer.
Mrs. Mugisha, talking about misinformation, what are some of the misinformation or perhaps the conspiracy theories that you've been encountering?
At the beginning of the lockdown, a lot of misinformation was being circulated, especially through the media and different online channels, the WhatsApp, and so people were actually receiving a lot of fear through the misinformation, and some of it contains things like coronavirus is only in the urban places, coronavirus is a simple flu that it comes and one can fight it in just a few minutes or a day or two, and also saying that COVID-19 only kills the elderly, and so the young and the youth are okay, even if they don't protect themselves. All this kind of information actually created fear in the lives of people, and so we as church, as faith leaders, we had to do something about it by raising awareness that the killer, and so increasing rates of infections and death created, helped curb this kind of misinformation, but also for people to be able to prevent themselves and the entire communities from spread.
Have you been working with other religious groups in Uganda in this quest to help fight the pandemic?
As women, our Mothers Union in Uganda, in the Church of Uganda, we do not work in isolation. Actually, we have Inter-Religious Council of Uganda. This is an organization that brings all faith together. We actually have different faith leaders coming together at different meetings and forums. And one of the key things that I've always come across that it is to talk about prevention. How do we curb, how do we reduce further spread in the communities of COVID-19? So it has been a joint effort. It has been collective responsibility.
Analysts that I spoke with in Uganda said it appears that the coronavirus is being used to suppress activities of opposition parties, and it has thwarted political activities, and that restrictions imposed by the government is being used to suppress efforts by the opposition to meet or perhaps campaign in readiness for next year's election. When you encounter some of these concerns, how do you overcome them in your education process about the need to fight the spread of the disease in Uganda?
As church, we stand by the truth, and the truth is in the Word of God. And so we encourage our people, we encourage the people that we lead to always do their role, do their part of prevention, do their role. And so if it is a gathering, if it is a rally, if it is a campaign, because right now we are into an election period, but people need to still be conscious and sensitive about COVID-19 because we have had death.
Mrs. Barbara Mugisha is of the province of the Church of Uganda. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The leadership of the Nigerian Bar Association is calling on the government to genuinely address the demands and concerns of protesters. The lawyers group also condemned the murder of unarmed protesters and police officers. This following an emergency meeting of the National Executive Committee of the group to deliberate on the state of Nigeria due to the protests. The group also expressed concern about the breakdown of the rule of law. The youth protesters demand greater inclusion in the country's politics as well as an end to police brutality. Dr. Rapolu Nduka is the National Publicity Secretary of the Nigerian Bar Association. He tells me that the lawyers group is calling on President Muhammadu Buhari's government to urgently launch a thorough and independent investigation to identify the masterminds and those who carried out the attack against the unarmed protesters and to ensure they face the full force of the law.
The main reason why we called that emergency meeting was for the NBA to actually deliberate on the state of the nation, look at the steps that we've taken so far, and then profile further steps that we may need to take, because we could not just sit down and just watch things get out of hand. People will normally ask, and people have been asking, what is NBA doing about this issue? So we had to really, you know, come together, look at the entire, what has really been going on in Nigeria as a whole, and then we profile them, we look at it, look for how we can come in as a body to, you know, kind of pressure, set in motion any step that can bring some normalcy.
What was the major overall outcome of this meeting about the steps you need to take in terms of speaking up as a pressure group?
The major, the summary of some of the things that we discussed, the outcome is that, number one, we condemned again the shooting that took place on that day. Now, we know that naturally the government has, we've had some denials. The Lagos State government says, what is in the news? The Lagos State governor said, oh, I don't know what really happened on that very day. So we condemned that. Then apart from condemning that, we now also said that the federal government must go the extra mile by fishing out whoever was behind the entire shooting. Because it's not enough for the government to just deny that the event happened. There are some videos by some persons who were present at the scene of the shooting. And so we asked for, number one, let the federal government actually fish out those who made the order in the first place, who asked the army or whoever did the shooting to go there to do the shooting. We also now also asked for that the channels be open for some kind of communication between the protesters and the government, because we all know that the protesters have a reason for the protest. And these reasons we are actually genuine reasons, because of the number of things that have been going on in the country for these years now. It's not just this administration, but even prior to this administration. Now, we also demanded that we should have these channels of communication open so that people can actually, or the voice of the protesters can actually be heard properly. Then one of the major areas, to generate a number of opposition, but one of the other major areas too, is that we demanded for a total overhaul of the Nigerian police and also the security and other paramilitary agencies within Nigeria.
Were members pleased with the response from the federal government or even from the state government in terms of addressing concerns of the protesters?
Members are not really pleased about that, definitely. Because I think the mood right now is that it seems as if the government is a little bit looking for an escape route, trying to divert attention to other things, and I'm not really addressing the concerns of the people. Now, let me just give this example. When we look at the protracted protest, you will notice that immediately this thing started, the government said, "Oh, we are resolving facts," but the protest continued because over time, we've had the government say, we will do this, and they never do that. So people were actually said, they're not glad or are not, do not believe the government when they now say, we will do this. Okay? Now, so the members of the NBA, most people that spoke at the meeting also, do not also believe that the government is actually taking any serious step in dealing with the issue at hand. And that's why we have this series of protests still going on.
Dr. Rapolu Nduka is the National Publicity Secretary of the Nigerian Bar Association. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Lagos. the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clonte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, Sports with Douglas Impuga, and music from our African collection. But first, Care for Free and Fair Elections, a Ghanaian civil society group, says the Inspector General of Police should be blamed if there is violence in the upcoming December general election. Ghanaians go to the polls in December to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives. But the group says the IGP has yet to implement measures that will inspire confidence that his officers will protect life and property during the election process. This following reports of isolated cases of violence during the recent voter registration process, as well as during a recent by-election. But some Ghanaians say the country will remain as peaceful as ever. David Kumi Ado is the Executive Secretary of Care for Free and Fair Elections. He talks to me about his group's concern regarding election-related violence during the December polls.
The integration of vigilantes into our police is destroying the integrity of the police service. Now, there are a lot of issues that occurred in the Iowa Super Sorghum by-election. There was violence in the by-election, and the just-ended registration exercise was also violent. Perpetrators of this violence have not been brought to book. We know a minister that pulled a gun and shot indiscriminately in crowd. Nothing has been done to that minister. And we are calling on the Inspector General, that is the IGP, Mr. James Opombuinu, to restore public confidence in the police service. Today, a lot of people are demanding for firearms because they believe that the police is unable to protect them. That is why we are calling the IGP to restore the confidence so that we can have peace going into this election and coming out of the election.
Some people are suggesting that your call that the Inspector General of Police should be blamed if there is any violence is misplaced, because the perpetrators of the violence should be the ones to be blamed and prosecuted for the crimes they commit, not the Inspector General of Police. What do you say to that?
The power to prosecute is in the hands of the police, and the police is led by the Inspector General. The Inspector General decides the things that happen because the Constitution has given him that right. So if we find that he's not doing his duty, he's not performing his duty to the satisfaction of the general public, then we will have to blame him because he's been paid with the taxpayers' money. And if he's not performing his duty and anything else happens, we experience violence in the elections, he should be blamed. Because people who have to be reprimanded for the violence and the atrocities they have meted onto other people is eroding the confidence that people have in the police service. That is why we are saying that the police, the Inspector General of Ghana Police, Mr. James Opombuinu, should be held responsible if he fails to restore public confidence in the police going into this election.
Some Ghanaians I spoke with are saying that Ghana has a track record of organizing peaceful elections since it embraced constitutional rule in 1992. So they don't expect any possible violence as you are predicting. What do you say to that?
You see, this election we are going into is not like any elections we have experienced in this country. Both leading parties, this tells us that we are heading towards an election that will be a cagey encounter between these political parties. And anything slight thing that will bring misunderstanding will bring chaos. People have lost confidence in the Electoral Commission as well, because most of the opposition political parties are saying that the Electoral Commission is biased because of some utterances that commissioners of the Electoral Commission have made, and there's some actions or decisions that they've taken. So you realize that going into this election, it will be a very different thing altogether.
Some of the Ghanaians I spoke with are of the view that they have confidence in the police because some of these instances of violence that you talked about are being investigated so the perpetrators could be brought to book, including the minister that you spoke about who you said shot indiscriminately. Why wouldn't you wait patiently and allow the police to finish investigation and prosecute the perpetrators if they have the evidence to back the allegations?
You see, the reason the name of our police, from the police force, a police service, is that the police is with the general public. So the police is the friend of the general public. But normally, when you are doing such things, you are conducting such investigations, you bring the people up to speed so that the people will know the actions, the activities, and the efforts you are putting in place. If you are telling us that you are conducting an investigation into a matter, and then the perpetrators are walking free, nothing has happened to them, no one will believe what you are saying. Meanwhile, others who have not
committed a crime. They are being held to court here and there, every now and then.
Will your organization approach the police or perhaps the Inspector General of Police to present your concerns?
As we speak to the general public, we have spoken to them because they are part of us. And everything we do, Care for Free and Fair Elections Ghana, Care Ghana, what we do is that if we have any concerns and we raise them in the public domain. For those who have to act on them, do so, so that it will not be like anything is covered in the dark. We bring the things to the fore so that everybody will know what we are talking about, to compel those who are supposed to act to act. So we are waiting on the Inspector General of Police to act so that we will know and have that belief that going into this election, any individual or group of persons who have an ambition to foment trouble or to perpetrate any violence will be brought to book.
David Kumi Adu is the Executive Secretary of Care for Free and Fair Elections. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. The Catalyst Fund, with its partners, have launched a $4.3 million inclusive digital commerce accelerator to improve the financial resilience of informal small and medium-sized enterprises in Ghana. The Catalyst Fund, which was established in 2016, is an accelerator that supports inclusive tech innovators and facilitates the group of innovation ecosystems in emerging markets. The fund, which will be in Ghana, seeks to improve the livelihoods and financial resilience of informal micro and small enterprises who have been adversely affected by the COVID-19 economic crisis. Officials say it will be done by enabling access to digital commerce platforms and access to markets. To learn more about the program and its anticipated prospect and impact, I read Jane Del Sir, the program lead for Ghana Catalyst Fund Inclusive Digital Commerce.
Catalyst Fund is an early stage inclusive fintech accelerator. And so with the support of MasterCard Foundation, which is based in the U.S. but has a presence in Ghana, there are different country offices. So with the support of MasterCard Foundation, we're able to launch this program. They bring the support of $4.3 million, and we're able to launch this inclusive digital commerce accelerator in Ghana.
What do you think are the prospects of this program?
So Catalyst Fund, as an accelerator, brings a proven model to accelerating early stage inclusive fintech companies in emerging markets. Our model is really about how we can provide tailored bespoke support that's deep to the needs of companies that are trying to do innovation in emerging markets. Launching a startup is already hard. An emerging or developing market, it's even harder. So we're able to bring the kind of bespoke venture acceleration support that allows us to work very closely with the companies and offer them the kind of support they need at the right time. This means that we're on the ground with them. We deliver the knowledge and expertise through experts who are in the markets where these companies operate. And so now we can bring this program to expanding it into digital commerce, where we can leverage the power of the digital economy, the power of digital and doing commerce online, so that we can reach more consumers and businesses, especially in the informal sector where they dominate in the markets where we work.
So what do you seek to achieve with this program?
So there are two things we're trying to achieve with this program. First, as we all have seen in the COVID pandemic, this has threatened the livelihoods of millions of people around the world. In the informal economy, this is estimated to have impact or threatened the livelihoods of 1.6 billion workers. And the program is focused in Ghana. The Ghanaian economy is characterized by informality. Most of the businesses, what you mentioned before, the micro, small, medium enterprises, they make up 92% of business and contribute about 70% to the GDP. So they're critical for the economy. And the smallest of those businesses, the micro enterprises, they're concentrated in the informal sector. And this is the part of the economy that's been really hard hit by the pandemic in particular. People are not able to physically go out and do their business, transact in commerce, and that means that their businesses and their incomes are affected. The informal economy is also where youth and women are, since there aren't many opportunities for formal employment. So there are populations that have been very much affected. And so we think that it's important for to address the issues brought on by the COVID pandemic to be able to leverage digital commerce in order to help people manage their livelihoods, potentially access more income, and build resilience by doing and engaging in the digital economy through digital commerce.
How significant an impact do you think this will have on individual organizations? Perhaps because I understand that the flexible grant capital is up to about $120,000. What impact will this have?
So the accelerator, as I mentioned earlier, I think we deliver outsized success because the model is really about understanding what these companies need at the stage that they're in, and being able to offer the very tailored approach to helping them address the barriers or whatever they're facing as a challenge to the startup, especially making sure they have the right product market fit in the early stage. In this program, because we're focusing on digital commerce, we're also focusing on growth stage companies. We're really looking for companies that have the potential to scale. They've demonstrated traction. They have about probably 1,000 MSE customers already. So we want to help these companies be able to scale so that the Canadian e-commerce ecosystem at large can also grow.
Jane Del Sir is the program lead for Ghana Catalyst Fund Inclusive Digital Commerce. She spoke with me from Spain's capital, Madrid. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In the African Champions League, Egypt's Al Ahly beat Wydad Casablanca of Morocco 3-1 in Cairo on Friday to reach this year's African Champions League final. Ahly, a record 8 times African champions, secured their place with a 5-1 aggregate victory, having won the first leg 2-0 in Casablanca the other weekend. Al Ahly have now won their last 17 home African Champions League games. This is the longest streak in the competition's history. Ahly will now face either Morocco's Raja Casablanca or Cairo rival Zamalek in next month's final, which will take place in Egypt. The Raja Zamalek semi-final second leg, which was due on Saturday, will now take place this weekend after having been postponed because of an outbreak of COVID-19 infections in the Raja camp. Meanwhile, the CAF Confederation Cup final is on Sunday between Egyptian club Pyramids FC and Moroccan club RS Bakene. Pyramids defeated Horaya SC of Guinea 2-0 in the semifinals, while Bakene edged out to fellow Moroccan side Hassania Agadir 2-1. Bakene lost last year's final on penalties to another Egyptian side, Zamalek Sports Club. In athletics, world 400 meters champion Salwa Eid Nasser has had her anti-doping violation charges dismissed by the World Athletics Disciplinary Tribunal. The 22-year-old Bahraini was provisionally suspended in June after being charged with missing 4 anti-doping tests. However, one whereabouts failure was dismissed because the doping control officer went to the wrong address. And as the 3 other missed tests were not within a 12-month period, they do not constitute a violation. The Athletics Integrity Unit has 30 days in which to appeal against the decision to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Nasser ran 48.14 seconds, the third fastest time in history to claim the world 400 meters title in Doha in 2019. She was born in Nigeria, but switched allegiance to Bahrain in 2014 and is the first Asian woman to be world champion in the discipline. In boxing, world heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua will defend his IBF, WBA, WBO and IBO titles against Kubrat Pulev on December 12th at the O2 Arena in London.
The 31-year-old Joshua last fought in December 2019 when he reclaimed his titles with a unanimous points victory in Saudi Arabia. Pulev was due to fight Joshua in June, but it was postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I know they do. fun days.
Nilichopata nikiomba walisema kitakwisha. Nikitoa shukrani hadharani wakasema najigamba. Hao binadamu walinipa wiki. Sasa imepita miaka bado wanasubiri.
Hey!
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sally, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Handoon, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the one who perseveres has no misfortune. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.